This is Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi. Sponsored by Hartford Healthcare, Rochford Eye Center, St. Francis Hospital, Covaris, and Yukon Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Healthy Rounds provides general information regarding medical conditions and diseases. The information is not intended to create a doctor-patient relationship. You're encouraged to consult your own medical provider for advice that applies to your own medical care. And now, Dr. Anthony Alessi on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com.
Welcome to Healthy Rounds, the show that provides you with up-to-date medical information and answers all of your health questions. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to be with you on this Saturday morning. Today we're going to have some interesting discussions. You know, sometimes when we hear about health conditions in the press, it really serves as a good springboard for us to learn more about these conditions and about what we can do for our own health and apply it. I think that's been the case in the past week. We learned that President Biden has a stage 4 prostate cancer. And again, it serves as a good reminder of what prostate cancer is, how you can diagnose it early and treat it. So we're going to have as our guest in the first segment, Dr. David Grew. Dr. Grew was a previous guest on our show. Actually, I looked it up about 5 years ago. He's a radiation oncologist, and he's going to talk to us about prostate cancer and more specifically the use of the cyber knife to treat prostate cancer. The other person we're going to have on in the second half is Dr. David Krueger. Dr. Krueger is an orthopedic spine surgeon, and I wanted to get him on because we've had several questions pertaining to the spine. One was specifically about Tarlov's cysts, so I asked him to come on. He's in practice with Advanced Orthopedics of New England, and he practices at St. Francis Hospital. The other topic that has come up, actually in the last 24 hours or so, has been a diagnosis of normal pressure hydrocephalus in Billy Joel. And, you know, more than getting into the nitty-gritty of their experiences, I think it's important to talk about it because right away when we hear the word hydrocephalus, right, we think of children with enlarged craniums, with some developmental disorders. And that's certainly not the case with this condition. So we don't expect Billy Joel's facial and cranial appearances to change. But if the diagnosis is correct, it's an interesting one that is relatively rare, but I actually think it's rarely recognized. I think it's seen more often than it's recognized. Let me explain. There's a specific triad of symptoms that you see with normal pressure hydrocephalus. Those are cognitive changes, a gait disturbance, and urinary incontinence. Those are the three hallmarks of this condition. When we talk about cognitive changes, it doesn't necessarily mean an outright dementia. It means some difficulty finding the right words, processing new information in terms of directions or how to follow a recipe, things such as that. The gait disturbance is also interesting because these are folks who lose their balance a lot. And they used to describe it as almost as a feeling as if you forgot how to walk. So you could see why these people would tend to fall. They have a relatively wide base to their gait, almost like a linebacker getting ready to get hit. And then urinary incontinence is also part of that triad. Now, I say that it's difficult to diagnose because you not only need some element of the triad, but a CT scan of the brain will show a buildup of spinal fluid in the ventricles, the fluid-filled chambers of the brain. You can also see this as we all get older and our brains become smaller. So just think about the brain as a closed space. And if you're taking away mass with atrophy as we get older, you're naturally going to see more spinal fluid and larger ventricles. That's something we call hydrocephalus ex vacuo, almost like a vacuum, and there's emptiness. So, and obviously there are other causes to people having cognitive changes, a gait disturbance, and urinary incontinence. So the diagnosis is made an interesting way. There are typically programs such as at the University of Connecticut, Hartford Healthcare, and I'm pretty sure they have one at St. Francis, where what they'll do is if a patient is suspected, they will admit them to the hospital and they will have testing done. They'll have cognitive testing with a speech pathologist. They will have videos made of their gait. And then they'll have a spinal tap. The spinal tap will drain a large amount of fluid. So get that fluid out, okay, almost to kind of shrink those ventricles. And then you observe the patient and test them for several days to see if they improved quantitatively from with respect to their gait, their urinary incontinence, and their cognitive changes. If indeed they have gotten significantly better with the tap, and it is a significant change, then they will have a shunt placed where fluid will be drained permanently from the brain to the abdomen. And in many cases, this serves as a cure. It certainly improves their symptoms dramatically. So again, that's the background to the idea of normal pressure hydrocephalus. It's a treated condition. It doesn't necessarily lead to Alzheimer's or other types of cognitive change. So with that, we wish Billy Joel the best and hope to see him back on tour again. This day in medicine, May 24th, 1898, Dr. Helen Taussig was born. We've heard of Dr. Taussig before. She's really the founder of pediatric cardiology here in the United States. And she's the first woman to hold a full professorship at Johns Hopkins University. But more importantly, she was the cardiologist who did a lot of the research behind treating what was called then blue baby syndrome, which was basically the what we would call best the tetralogy of Fallot. It's four abnormalities in the heart itself that would cause blood not to be oxygenated, thus resulting in unoxygenated blood and what they call the blue baby syndrome. So today we remember Dr. Helen Taussig. Next up, we're going to have a chat with my guest, Dr. David Grew, radiation oncologist at St. Francis Hospital. We're talking about prostate cancer. If you'd have questions for Dr. Grew, you can email me at info@alessimd.com, and I'm happy to pose those questions to Dr. Grew. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to be with you on this Saturday morning. My guest is Dr. David Grew. Dr. Grew is a radiation oncologist at St. Francis Hospital, and he uses the CyberKnife, and he's been on our program about 5 years ago when we had a discussion about this. But today I wanted to get him on to talk a little bit about prostate cancer in light of the recent diagnosis of President Biden. Welcome back, David.
Hey, yeah, great to be back. Thanks for having me back.
Can you talk a little bit in general about prostate cancer? I mean, how common is it? Are we seeing, what ages are we seeing it in? Can you give us some background to this condition?
Sure. Yeah, great place to start. So prostate cancer, aside from skin cancer, prostate cancer is the most common cancer in men. It's so common, it's actually 1 in 8 men will be diagnosed with prostate cancer at some point in their lifetime. It's generally a disease of older men. So most patients are affected are over the age of 50. And we also know that family history and race matter? So African-American men and those patients who have a personal family history of prostate cancer, we know they're at higher risk.
So when one of the things I guess we always think about is screening for the problem, whether it be with somebody with a family history, African-American as a socioeconomic group. So how is the diagnosis made?
Yeah, great question. So the vast majority of patients that we see and take care of with prostate cancer don't have any symptoms, actually, at the time that they're diagnosed. Almost all of them are diagnosed because of a simple screening test, which I'll go into in a second. It's called the PSA. It's a blood test. And PSA stands for prostate-specific antigen. But when symptoms do occur, they're sort of generalized urinary symptoms. So trouble urinating, frequent urination, especially at night. What makes it confusing is that actually those symptoms I just mentioned are far more common with a benign condition, meaning a non-cancer condition called BPH. So it can lead to some confusion. And when those symptoms are present, there very often isn't even cancer. That's just a benign condition. So we do heavily rely on this test called the PSA test. It's a simple blood test that can be drawn by your primary care doctor. It can be tracked over time. And if it starts going up or if it's elevated out of the normal range, that can trigger a deeper conversation and maybe some next steps to perhaps even look into whether or not there might be prostate cancer present.
So in addition to the PSA test, well, let's since we're on the subject of the PSA test, here's something that's come up, and it seems to be somewhat controversial, is when do you start screening with the PSA test? And more importantly, when do you stop screening, or should you ever stop screening with a PSA blood test?
Great thing to discuss, because this is a controversial area. And when I say controversial, what I really mean is different groups of doctors don't all agree on exactly whether and when we should start the PSA screening. So there are some groups that recommend screening as early as in the 40s, starting at around 40 or 45, at least having a discussion with your doctor about the PSA test, what it's used for, and some of the data around how it can find prostate cancer. And then on the long end, there's some controversy. So after age 70, there's some controversy. Some groups believe we should be continuing to do screening in that age group. So the one group that's getting a lot of press more recently is the United States Public Service Task Force. And so it's USPSTF. And this group is charged with making official recommendations from the government about when and how we should be doing screening for cancer. And their current stance is that screening should go from age 55 to age 69. And specifically, I mean screening with PSA for prostate cancer. The reason that's controversial is because there are a lot of men who are over age 69 who are quite fit. They're in really good shape. They would be very willing to pursue curative treatment for prostate cancer. And so they, in fact, do undergo treatment, even though it's or undergo screening, even though it's technically against the recommendations of this public service task force. So what we see in our group, in our practice, is that a lot of men in that age group are actually discussing this with their primary care doctors and opting in, and in fact, going and doing that screening. And in some cases, we find prostate cancer that could potentially be life-threatening. And then those patients have curative treatment, and they go on and live relatively normal, healthy lives.
Here's the thing that bothers me. I don't see a downside to it in terms of getting the test done. It's not one of those tests where you're going to get a false positive and do some radical surgery, because if you did get a positive result. I mean, it could be due to prostatitis or something else. It would just prompt a further investigation as opposed to leading to. I just don't. And we come up against this on this program all the time with the Preventive Services Task Force, whether it be with breast cancer, colon cancer. They seem to go in a very conservative way, and in some cases, I believe, an unhealthy way, and really contradict what they're supposed to be doing. But I got to ask you, what's the downside to getting a PSA over the age of 70?
Well, I'll say, as an oncologist, I generally agree with you. I'm in favor of finding cancers and curing them. But for the purpose of just like having a healthy debate, I can at least try to articulate the argument that they would make, which is that if you start screening that population, you're going to start finding cancers that would never be life-threatening if you never knew about them. Mm-hmm. Okay. However, you will be putting those patients through the stress and the side effects and risks and long-term effects of treatment, whether those patients end up undergoing surgery with a radical prostatectomy, sure, or radiation therapy or hormone therapies. If you find a cancer and it gets treated, those patients will experience some side effects and risks. And their argument is that, well, most of those prostate cancers that you're going to find would never be life-threatening because patients in that age group have a lot of other competing, correct, risks on their life. Cardiovascular disease, you know, stroke, heart attacks, things like that are much more likely statistically to be the things that would be life-threatening events for those patients. And so their argument is, we should, if you take this entire group of patients altogether, then, you know, we're going to be treating a lot of patients who would never realize a benefit from having surgery for prostate cancer or having radiation for prostate cancer because they will eventually statistically have a heart attack or a stroke or some other reason and they'll die. I don't buy into that either for the exact same reasons you articulated. Just for the sake of having a healthy public debate, I believe that is their argument.
Yeah, but I mean, there's a decision to be made. You have information, you make a decision, and in some cases, you wouldn't do anything with prostate cancer. But I want to move on. We only have a couple of minutes left. Can you talk a little bit about the cyber knife and how that's kind of revolutionized treatment of prostate cancer?
Sure. So CyberKnife is a specific tool that we have here at St. Francis that it's a radiation machine that enables us to deliver very precise and accurate radiation in very high doses to the prostate. So because it's so precise, it allows us to compress a typically pretty long course of radiation, which historically was up to 9 weeks. In some cases now we can do it over six weeks of treatment, but the CyberKnife allows us, because of its precision, to compress all of those treatment days into just 5 days. It's about a week and a half. We do the treatments every other day. So through layers of technology and additional imaging procedures that allow us to be super accurate with the treatment, we can safely deliver this prostate cancer treatment with precise radiation in just a week and a half. So that tends to be cheaper for payers, but more importantly, it tends to be very, very convenient for patients. Patients are coming from a distance, or if they have a work schedule, or if they just value their time, they don't want to be going back and forth from a cancer center every day for 9 weeks. This ends up being a really fantastic option for them.
And how about the the success rate with it?
Sure. So it's generally comparable to the other treatment options, which would be radical prostatectomy, the surgery that's done for prostate cancer, as well as those other radiation techniques that I mentioned. It's generally comparable to the 9 weeks or the 5.5 or 6 weeks of treatment. The exact success rates really depend on the stage of the disease and other factors like how high was the PSA, had the cancer had really aggressive features under a microscope, the grade, the Gleason score, had it spread anywhere on scans, those kinds of things have a much higher effect on the success rates than the technology platform. So we don't see that that CyberKnife necessarily is going to allow us to achieve higher cure rates. It's just allowing us to deliver the treatment faster and more accurately.
David, thank you. Thank you for your time today, and thank you for bringing us up to date. For those of you interested in evaluations for prostate cancer, you can reach out to Dr. Grew at 860-714-4568. We're going to take a short break, then we're going to be back with Dr. David Krueger. We're talking about spine surgery and actually using the Mako robotic computer for spine surgery. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it gives me great pleasure to introduce our second guest for today, Dr. David Krueger. Dr. Krueger is an orthopedic spine surgeon with Advanced Orthopedics of New England. He practices at St. Francis Hospital, part of Trinity Health of New England. David, welcome back to the show.
Hey, hi, Tony.
Let's talk a little bit about spine surgery because it's such a vast field. I mean, in addition to orthopedic surgery, in looking at your bio, I mean, you did a lot of work after that in research, fellowship, and things such as that. Can you talk a little bit about some of the conditions you treat and some of the training required to become an orthopedic spine surgeon?
Sure. Actually, most of spine care is not surgical. Most of it's not operative. I had a college degree and I went to medical school. And then I did a 5-year orthopedic residency, but I added a year to that because I did a year of research. And then I spent a 7th year doing a spine fellowship, learning to do spine surgery and non-operative spine care. And I've been at Advanced Orthopedics New England my entire career. So it's kind of like the first real job I've ever had. The most common things we see are usually back pain and to a lesser degree neck pain, and those are generally speaking not operative conditions. Back pain is extremely common. About 80% of the population will lose some work time during their career because of back pain, and it's the second most common cause of work loss behind the common cold. So we see a lot of that, and like I said, that's almost never an operative problem. It's usually self-limited. They go away. The pain either goes away or substantially less in a week or two or three. And treatment for that is usually controlled activity, so definitely not bed rest, but frequent short walks and moderate activity. Other things that can be helpful for that are over-the-counter medications, and sometimes we recommend physical therapy or chiropractic care. I'm one of the co-directors of the Spine Institute of Connecticut at Trinity Health. And we also have the Comprehensive Spine Institute, which is non-operative back care run by a physiatrist.
Do injections help? I mean, so more and more people are having epidural steroid injections. And I guess I would still consider that non-operative care. How effective are they?
I have sort of a special prejudice against spinal injections, particularly epidural steroid injections. They have been shown to be useful for patients with soft disc herniations with radicular pain. That is, they've herniated a disc and they have leg pain. They can reduce the pain, usually on a temporary basis, while the patient heals on their own. That is the natural history. So the natural history is what would happen if you were a cave person. So if you didn't get eaten by a saber-toothed tiger and you didn't starve to death, the natural history for disc herniation is favorable. You would get better. So what epidural steroid injections can do is sort of put on a very effective Band-Aid until you heal. They're used widely for other conditions. Most notably where they're ineffective is for back pain or spinal arthritis, and they have been shown to be very ineffective and extremely cost ineffective. Of course, the problem is that everyone knows someone's aunt or grandmother who had the shot for the same reason and got better,
right.
And the people either aren't getting better and either they don't want or are not a surgical candidate, and things like exercise, weight control, and not smoking are either something they can't do or have tried and hasn't worked. So epidural steroid injections and, in general, facet injections, medial branch blocks, are expensive, ineffective intervention.
Let's talk a little bit about the surgical side of things. So what kind of things do you treat surgically?
The most common things we treat surgically are either disc herniations, which is like the crab meat between the bones that pops out and pushes on a nerve. And if it doesn't get better over time, then an Exxon operation is to surgically go in there and remove the piece of disc that's pushing on the nerve. And it's extremely effective operation. It's outpatient surgery, and people recover very quickly. We also do procedures generally also with leg symptoms, or in the case of the cervical spine, arm symptoms. Cervical spine's the neck. So with arm symptoms or leg symptoms, they can have arthritis that narrows the canal where the nerves live. That's called spinal stenosis, and that's narrowing of the spine, and either in the main part of the spine or commonly where the spine exit, where the nerves exit the spine, called the foramina. So that would be foraminal stenosis. And there's a variety of different procedures that can be done for that, either free up the nerves, very similar to what we do for a discectomy, and or free up the nerves and stabilize, that is, fuse the spine. So that's probably the second most common thing.
What makes you decide when somebody needs surgery and they've failed conservative treatment?
That's a very interesting question, and sadly has changed over the years because of insurance companies and micromanagement.
Yeah, I bet.
But typically, people would benefit from spine surgery when they have what's called appendicular pain. So that is arm or leg pain, not axial pain, which is central spine pain. So typically they benefit from surgery with appendicular pain that's been there for a reasonable period of time, which is typically felt to be 6 weeks. After 6 weeks, people that haven't gotten better, the odds of them getting better on their own go down rather significantly. So the longer you have it, the longer you have it. So people that have appendicular pain for more than 6 weeks and have failed non-operative treatments such as rest, avoiding noxious activities, physical therapy, and then there's the big and, they don't want to deal with it anymore because the pain is more than they want to deal with. You don't have to have a surgery. You don't have to have surgery because it hurts. You can choose to live with that pain, and a lot of people do. Those are what are called relative indications for surgery, and then there's absolute indication for surgery, which is either progressive profound weakness of a body part, such as your knee is weak and you're falling down, or a condition called Cauda-Quinea syndrome, when you start to lose function of your bowel and bladder. And then in the cervical spine, that is in your neck, an absolute indication for surgery is if your spinal cord's being compressed. Yeah, that's an absolute indication for surgery.
You touched on Cauda-Equina syndrome, and how often do you see it? I mean, as a neurologist, I see it occasionally, and it doesn't necessarily have to be cancer related. But how often do you see people presenting with true Cauda-Equina syndrome?
We think about it every day, every patient, and almost never see it.
Okay.
Very rare.
Okay, so agreed. What are the typical symptoms? Maybe share a little bit with people the symptoms of Cauda-Equina, the things that make you want to do things, intervene more urgently. And I think Cauda-Equina, that's why you're saying we think about it every day.
Yes.
People are aware of that.
Sure. That's like pulling a fire alarm if you have true Cauda-Equina syndrome. So typically, and you can present with any or all of these or combination, both legs hurt, or both legs are numb or heavy, but they usually hurt with some numbness. And that's not the critical part. The critical part is numbness in your privates. We call it the perineum. So numbness in your privates and some sort of bladder or fecal either incontinence, so you're peeing on yourself, or you're pooping on yourself, or you can't pee, so you're in retention. And then what some people get is they go in retention, they get what's called overflow incontinence, so they get both. They can't pee and they're urinating on themselves. And that's a true emergency.
I have a question here that just came up from Bob, and that is, he's saying, many years ago I had a myelogram of my spine, and now I've had recently had an MRI. What's the difference?
Sure. The myelogram, we still use those, but it's extremely rare. Prior to the invention of the CAT scan or the MRI, we would put a radiopaque dye in the nerve tube, in the dura, where the nerves live, and take x-rays. And we could then see things pushing on the nerves, such as spinal stenosis, narrowing of the tube, a disc herniation, cancer, broken bones, things like that. And then with the development of the CAT scan, we were able to do that with the CAT scanner. And then we got sort of a combination effect where we do a myelogram and then do a CT scan, because you can see better with there's contrast in there. With the advent of the MRI, we don't need to use intrathecal contrast. That is, we no longer need to put a needle in people's spine to see things. Generally speaking, that's a good enough test. Now, some people do get contrast with their MRIs. It's called gadolinium. And they're given gadolinium, generally speaking, when they've had previous spine surgery, because that helps differentiate between scar and like a new disc herniation.
You know, I think you and I probably both remember when myelograms used to have to not only put the dye in, but you had to take it out as well before metrizumide, right?
Yeah. Oh, not only that, when I was a resident, we used to admit the people the night before to do a myelogram the next day.
Yeah.
So it was a big deal. And now you just go to the, you know, outpatient MRI and you're done in 45 minutes.
Absolutely fascinating. I guess the next question is, one of the things you brought up already was compression of the cervical spine. And I think probably in my practice, I often see people who may have waited too long in terms of having these progressive symptoms. Can you talk a little bit about people, what should they be aware of if they are potentially dealing with a cervical myelopathy or compression of the spinal cord in the neck?
Sure. So if you have a compression of the spinal cord, I mean, it can present anywhere from like neck pain, which is not common, or four extremity symptoms. And the things we really look out for are bilateral arm pain, bilateral arm symptoms, that is both arms are a problem, losing skills or fine manipulatives, like zippers, doing buttons, things like that, if you lose that skill. And then critical also is if you have lower extremity symptoms from your neck. And usually people get either incoordinated, like their legs are stupid, or they're walking like they're almost drunk. One of the problems with myelopathy, it doesn't have to be painful at all. It just can be present with lack of coordination.
How about walking? I mean, I always see people, a lot of times I see them, they come in and they've had these frequent falls as well.
Sure. Like on lower extremity symptoms, lack of coordination or falling down. And you know, it's very interesting, particularly in old people or people with rheumatoid arthritis before the modern drugs were available. People would say, oh, grandma's just old and weak. And in actual fact, her spinal cord was being pinched. And particularly the older people, if you catch that earlier, they can get return of function. So that's really important to keep an eye out for that.
So that's an interesting point. So how often do you see return of function after decompression? Because one of the objectives is to stop the progression of these myelopathic symptoms, this weakness, numbness, and falling. But how often do you see recovery?
Again, that's a really interesting question. When I operate on people for myelopathy, what I tell them is a good result is they don't get worse, and an excellent result is they get better. So I really have to sort of hang crepe when it's myelopathy. Typically, people that improve with myelopathy, as in most things, they have less severe disease, so it's not as bad myelopathy. But they're younger, because younger people bounce better than older people, and they've not had the disease for as long. So a good patient would be a young person who's minimally symptomatic, almost caught by accident because someone thought they had carpal tunnel syndrome and they haven't had it for a long time. And then, of course, a bad outcome would be someone in their 80s who've had it for 15 years and their spinal cord's highly compressed. That's very unlikely for that second patient to note a lot of improvement.
One of the questions I had recently was about Tarlov cysts in the spine, something we see occasionally on MRIs. As we've developed these newer diagnostic procedures, we start to see more and more other things and don't know how to respond. Can you talk a little bit about Tarlov cysts and the proper approach to treatment?
Sure. Generally speaking, Tarlov cysts are an incidental finding and are well served to be ignored. They're arachnoid cysts, which is one of the lining. The arachnoid is one of the linings around the nerves in your spine. And you can get an outpouching or kind of like a hernia of that, and you get an arachnoid cyst. Generally speaking, they're not felt to be symptomatic, and they do not cause problems. I've never operated on a Tarlov cyst, and I've never met someone who's operated on a Tarlov cyst. There are reports of Tarlov cysts that can cause neurologic problems, and there are reports of people operating on those cysts. Now, this is extremely rare stuff. This is stuff you read about. You don't meet people that do this. The problem with operating on Tarlov cysts is it's technically very demanding because there's nerves inside the cyst, so you can damage those nerves. There's a high complication rate, and some surgeons report that the benefits, if they occur, are short-lived. So generally, Tarlov cysts are something best ignored.
So when you say they're short-lived, is that because the cyst just regrows?
I'll be honest with you, I've never met a patient or met a doctor who's had an operation on a Tarlov cyst, so I can only tell you what I've read about
it. Okay. Well, listen, I think that answers Michael's question. The next thing I wanted to talk about was the use of the Mako robotics. And, you know, we've heard a lot about this in terms of joint replacements from the orthopedic end of things, in terms of using the computerization and this robotic procedures, again, in prostate surgery. But until this discussion, I've not heard about it in the use of spine surgery. Can you bring us up to speed on the robotics approach to spine surgery and if it's helped and how much it's helped?
Well, I can, but I'm going to have to take a time out for a short advertisement. The newest spine robot on the market is the Mako spine robot, which is an extension of the Mako joint robot, which is the biggest joint robot in the world. There have been a variety of spine robots here and there. The Mazor and a company called Globus has one. But the Mako spine robot has just been released, and at St. Francis Hospital, we're one of the very, very first hospitals in the country to have one. So we're actually a teaching center for the Mako robot, which is very interesting. So now my commercial's over.
Okay. Perfectly allowed on this program.
The major advance in spine surgery is navigation. Navigation is really like science fiction. So the patient comes to the operating room, and we hook to their skeleton an array that a camera and a computer can see. And then we take a CAT scan in the operating room, and now the computer can see where the patient is, and it knows where the patient's spine is from the CAT scan. And then every tool you use, every screwdriver, every drill, knows where the tip of the drill is. It knows where the drill is, and it can draw augmented reality. It can draw cartoons showing you where the screw is and where the screw's going. So that's navigation. That has been, in my mind, the fundamental advance in this. Now, robots take the next step. Robots hold and position the tool and can actually even turn the tool off automatically where you want to place the screw or the piece of hardware. So the robot is an extension of the navigation and can be quite useful, particularly in things like percutaneous procedures, that is when you're putting the screws into the spine through nearly non-existent incisions. And it can also be very helpful when really big operations, like scoliosis operations, when you want to line up 10 or 20 screws all in a row. So if you can plan out in advance so they all line up in a straight row, then the computer can figure out where to put the screws so that happens, and then the robot arm goes to the place where to put in the screws so after they're in, they're straight.
Has it clearly improved outcomes?
No, it hasn't. I think the navigation has clearly improved outcomes. People can do operations that previously were extremely challenging. You'd use x-rays, so it was a significant dose of radiation to the patient and a potentially deadly dose of radiation to the surgeons, because there's associated increased cancer rate for surgeons that use a lot of radiation mm-hmm. in the operating room, and it was a lot of radiation to put in those screws. So it's a safety factor, not only for radiation, but for putting the screws in the right place, which also permits surgeons to maybe do operations that they might have thought were too hard for them in the past, make it a lot easier and safer. So that has been an advance. It clearly shows benefit. As far as I know, the robot has not actually shown a lot of clinical benefit, but it can be helpful.
In closing, David, what's one thing you'd like to make the public and listeners aware of with respect to spine surgery and the state of spine surgery today?
I'm going to back that out a little bit and make it about spine care, because most people don't get spine surgery and certainly don't need spine surgery. I think the thing I see the most that it's not helpful is people are really scared of their spines. You know, they get a cold and they think it's okay, and they get a cut in their forearm and they think it's okay. They may even break a bone and they think that, okay, that's going to heal them. Okay. Well, you get a backache or you get a herniated disc. It's like, oh my God, my life is over. How can a disc get better without surgery? And people are just frankly scared of their backs and their necks. And they shouldn't be, because once you kind of get over the fact that it's probably not something horrible and it's going to go away on its own or go away with simple treatment, you really feel a lot better. Just the notion that, oh my God, I'm going to have to live like this the rest of my life, it's completely not helpful.
David, thank you. Thank you for your time today. And thank you for all you do for our patients and our community.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
And for anyone wishing to reach out to Dr. Krueger, you can reach him through Advanced Orthopedics of New England, 860-728-6740. Thanks again, David.
You bet. Take care. Bye-bye.
All right. We're going to take a short break. They're going to be back to wrap things up. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. Welcome back. Many thanks to our guests today, Dr. David Grew and Dr. David Krueger, for interesting discussions overall. Many thanks to our studio producer, Kevin Kors, who's been on the board, and Matt Sarois and Joey Burgoyne are always around to help us out. Jeff Chandler's in charge of sales and marketing for Healthy Rounds. Next week on Healthy Rounds, we're going to have a taped program since I'm going to be on the road, but we will have some new introductory information. You know, this Make America Healthy Again group has now released their encyclical of 70 or so pages and basically given us information that we already had about dyes and pesticides and childhood obesity. The one thing it doesn't have are any solutions. So we're going to drill down on that a little bit next week. Once again, I'm always taking your questions. You could reach me at info@alessimd.com. If you missed any part of today's program, you can get it on the Healthy Rounds podcast. Just download it at odyssey.com or Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Next up on WTIC is going to be Law Talk with attorney John Matulis. Until next week, this is Dr. Anthony Alessi. Please stay healthy.
This has been Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi, sponsored by Hartford Healthcare, Rochford Eye Center, St. Francis Hospital, Covaris, and UConn Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Be sure to tune in next Saturday morning at 11 for more Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com. Till then, stay well.